Soldiers returning from war have always been welcomed home with speeches from politicians. Praise is lavished for bravery shown on the battlefield. Promises are made that the sacrifice will not be forgotten, all to the sound of patriotic tunes. The soldiers who served in World War I had been paid $1 a day and a 25-cent stipend for every day spent overseas. As a bonus for their service, Congress in 1924 passed a law calling for every veteran of the Great War to receive an additional dollar for every day served. But the payment would not be made for another 20 years, prompting soldiers to dub it the tombstone bonus, because it was more likely to be paid upon death than as a benefit to be enjoyed during the veteran's own life. Frustration festered during the 1920s, and with the Great Depression, frustration turned to anger. A bill was introduced in Congress to pay the bonus immediately.
This out-of-work canning worker in Portland, Oregon, named Walter W. Waters, gets up, starts to mobilize his buddies. He said, let's go to Washington and lobby, just like we're a big steel company, lobby to get this bill passed.
Paul Dixon is the co-author of a new book entitled The Bonus Army, An American Epic. He joined us this past week in Anacostia Park, just across the Anacostia River from downtown Washington, D.C. He told us what happened after Walter Waters and thousands of veterans from around the country finally arrived in Washington in late May 1932.
They had a police chief here who was ready for these guys, who wanted them here. So he presented this whole area where we're sitting right now. He brought down lumber so they could build shacks. He laid it out like a military camp with street names, and it was a beautifully organized thing, because he realized that there was nothing he could do to stop them, so he might as well just make it work as well as he could.
Tell us about the chief of police.
Pelham Glassford was a remarkable man. He was the youngest brigadier general in World War I. He was a heroic. He was West Point. But he was also a bohemian of sorts. He gets along with everybody. He's a large man who rides a blue motorcycle, never gets in a squad car, and he makes a deal with these guys. So he and Waters sort of keep the place under control as long as they can.
Tell us about the camp that the veterans built here. What kind of amenities did they have?
It was a wonderfully interesting place. The local people in Washington loved these guys. They were war heroes. They brought their wives and children with them. And there were guys walking around with medals, with, you know, bona fide major heroes of World War I were here. It was an integrated camp. There was a piano in the middle of the thing. So you'd often have, you know, a black guy up there playing St. Louis blues and a white guy up there playing shanty in old shantytown. There was music everywhere. There were huge stews, huge cauldrons of mulligatawny stews. And there were boxing matches, baseball games. There were gospel choirs that came in. It had sort of its own MPs, the people that patrolled it, made sure it was clean, that nobody was, you know, there was no drinking allowed. No communists were allowed. You had to be a registered veteran. And if you were a communist veteran, you had to go across the river to another camp.
Now, how much of that was imposed by the veterans themselves? How much of that was the D.C. police under Glassford?
That was mostly done by the veterans who really wanted to. There was a lot of fear in that in 1932 of communism. So, and that was later used to tar this whole incident, which in fact, there were only about 150 communists in the whole thing. But Waters decided he wanted to keep them out because he thought they had a different agenda.
Roy Wilkins was a young reporter from the NAACP's magazine Crisis, and he visited here. What did he see?
He is flabbergasted by the racial integration. He sees pup tents with black feet and white feet sticking out. And he sees this as the model for the future. He sees an America that he thinks is possible, finally. He really believes that integration will work. But if you were reading the New York Times or reading the Washington Post, this is never alluded to. The integration of the Bonus Army is one of the deepest kept secrets in American history.
What are your thoughts sitting here where the Bonus Army camped?
My thoughts sitting here with the Bonus Army camped is that this was a turning point in American history. This was the beginning of an epic of how we redress our grievances in this country. And I think it also was the model. It should have been the model for racial integration. And it didn't happen, but it showed you what it could be.
The Bonus Army behaved well, and their lobbying of Congress was intense, but it was not enough to approve the bill. Though it passed the House, the Senate voted it down. In the eyes of the Hoover administration, the bonus marchers had lost their political fight and now should leave. But they didn't. A confrontation loomed.
We've crossed the Anacostia River and are now at 3rd Street and Pennsylvania Avenue, where the east wing of the National Gallery of Art now stands. We're less than 3 blocks from the Capitol building. In 1932, there were some buildings here about to be torn down, and veterans were staying in them. On July 28, 1932, President Hoover moved to evict them.
The day started out badly. They started to evict these guys, the police did, and it got pretty violent. There was some bricks thrown, and there was some punches thrown. There's some anger among the veterans who feel they've been betrayed. They thought they had a little bit more time to get out. And a cop who's literally lost control of himself, they've been pushing and shoving, and he's had a brick thrown at him. But he loses control, and Glassford sees this and starts yelling at the guy to stop. And the cop actually fires at Glassford, missing him, and then turns around and shoots 2 guys. And at this point, the army is mobilized to come in.
And heading that army was Chief of Staff Douglas MacArthur, a man who was sure communists were controlling the bonus marchers. He wanted them out once and for all. MacArthur's principal aide, Dwight Eisenhower, urged caution. But MacArthur was not a cautious man.
MacArthur comes across the bridge from Fort Myer with the tanks, with the guys with bayonets. There's another infantry unit coming up from Fort Washington up the river, and they all coalesce on downtown Washington. And then it gets really brutal there. They burn all the shacks downtown. You know, one guy is approached by a soldier, pushes him out of the way, and they realize this guy's wearing the Croix de Guerre and another medal from World War I, and they see that they're really up against guys who are brave, but they keep going, and there are tens of thousands of civilians who've been attracted by this. They've been talking about it all day on the radio, so they're driving civilians off the mall. They're driving, some civilians get arrested and end up in trucks. There's powerful tear gas used, tanks, bayonets. People can't believe the sight of these tanks in the street coming down Pennsylvania Avenue.
MacArthur burned and cleared the Pennsylvania Avenue camps. That evening, he went further and headed his troops toward the Anacostia camp.
There's one newspaper man who actually stands up to MacArthur and says, "You have no right to burn these guys out." And MacArthur does give them, he negotiates with some of them. He gives them an hour to get all of them out of the camp because he's going to torch it. And then they torch it, and they say it's a conflagration like nobody's ever seen. And we have witnesses that we interviewed in the book who are on the river and see this huge fire. These are tar paper and cardboard shacks and tons of wood, and just huge flames going up over the city.
Did MacArthur exceed his orders?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There were the written orders. He said at one point, "I don't have time for written orders." He's basically told by the White House to only drive them out of downtown. I think going across the river was a turning point for this whole thing, because everything became more dramatic at that point when they burned them out. And people would, there'd be stories in the paper the next day, and a woman would say, "Can I run back in this shack to get my clothes for my baby?" And they'd say no, and they'd push her aside. And these were heroes.
In Torture House.
Yeah, in Torture House.
What was the media coverage like?
It was extraordinarily good. And what was amazing was the newsreel cameras got this thing.
"The bonus veterans have defied their leaders. The police cannot handle them since the riot this morning that ended in one death and dozens wounded. And so they're being forced out of their shacks by smoke bombs and tear gas hurled by the troops who have been called out by the President of the United States."
And there's MacArthur strutting about, in his puttees and his boots. And people in theaters all across the country saw this and MacArthur's booed in the newsreels. And I don't think anybody in authority had any idea what the public reaction was, because the public regarded these guys as heroic, and they saw them in the same boat. They were not only heroic, but they were actually standing up to the government. They're saying, "Look, the government's got to do something." And so when they see the United States Army driving out these heroes of the last war, it's an extraordinary moment for a lot of Americans.
And Roosevelt was elected. He did not want to approve the bonus for veterans any more than Hoover did. What did he do differently over the next few years?
Roosevelt allowed them to come and protest again in 33 and then again in 34. He gives some of them jobs in the Civilian Conservation Corps, which was basically an army of tree cutters. But he doesn't give them the bonus. In fact, he cuts veterans' benefits. One of the first things in office, he cuts. And then when the bonus comes up again, the immediate payment, it's passed by Congress. Both houses pass it this time. But he vetoes it before a joint session of Congress. And he says the country can't afford this. And, of course, they come back again in 34, and then he sends a lot of these guys to work camps in the Florida Keys.
Tell us what happened at the veterans' camps in Florida on Labor Day, 1935.
A powerful hurricane, unlike any other hurricane that's ever been recorded hitting the Western Hemisphere, slammed into the Keys, and there had been 250 veterans were killed in an hour. The winds were so intense, there were about 250 miles an hour winds, that literally some of the veterans died when their skin was just... The sand and the little stones were just used as like missiles and just took the skin off their body.
Oh, my.
And immediately, well, the first journalist to show up is Ernest Hemingway. And Hemingway immediately writes this intensely, the angriest thing he's ever written, accusing the New Deal of being responsible for the deaths of these veterans. The deaths of the veterans literally turns the country around so much that the next year the bonus passes. I mean, their deaths are in fact part of the narrative, the part of what causes the Congress to finally be able to muster enough votes to override Franklin D. Roosevelt's third veto of the bonus.
Your final chapter deals with the legacy of the bonus army, and especially one particular piece of legislation. Tell us about that.
Well, as the first guys come back from World War II, they're running into some problems. There's not enough medical care. It's a problem that always happens during the war. A lot of the caseworkers at the VA have been drafted, and they don't have enough people to deal with wounded men who've lost limbs. And there's this huge thing building in Congress that says that we can't let this bonus army happen again. Now we've got over 10 million guys coming back, 14 million people coming back, and we've got to take care of them. And that's what a very bright man named Colmery, who worked for the American Legion, comes up with this vision. He was a World War I vet. In the Mayflower Hotel, he goes to the Mayflower Hotel, and on Mayflower Stationery, he writes out this GI Bill of Rights. It said, you have a right to housing, you have a right to an education, you have to right to all these things. It's a very tense moment. The bill is passed over some very strange and powerful people who don't want it, segregationists who don't want it, and some elite educators who don't want it for other reasons because they're afraid of too many of these guys coming to fill up the elite universities. But it gets passed, and what happens is it transforms America. It propelled millions of people who had come out of the Depression and gone to war. It propelled them into the middle class with housing, with education. And it was an extraordinary time for America. And it was the model for how veterans should be treated after a war. And whatever veterans get now, and I know there's a lot of debate about what they're not getting, but whatever they do get is largely a result of a motion that began with the Bonus Army.
Paul Dixon is co-author, along with Thomas Allen, of The Bonus Army, an American Epic, published by Walker Books. Thanks so much for coming out with us today.
Thank you, Sheila.
For more on the Bonus Army, including a vintage newsreel and a photo gallery, go to our website, npr.org.
Soon one morning, I was lying in the bed, picked up the paper, this is what it says. The bonus have been beat to it, but they passed it anyhow. I said, thank God Almighty, I wish I had it now. When I get my bonus, I ain't gonna throw it away. I'm gonna say it's time to live on. Working hard won't pay.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.